Well, good morning and welcome to Consider This. I'm Joe Clark.
And I'm Ken Dilger.
So happy to have you along, Ken. Glad we're all here. Hope you've been enjoying some of the spring weather finally starting to come. And get anything done at all, Ken?
Not too much. Raked some leaves on the outside. Picked up some, we have a dead tree in our yard that's probably a little bit overdue.
Uh-oh.
So any type of a strong wind comes, a lot of sticks and some branches fall off. Ooh. So I've been picking up that on a monthly basis.
So you're waiting for them to fall and picking them up as opposed to planning for the imminent.
Well, it's kind of a tight little situation between my yard and my neighbor's fence. So, we're a couple big storms away from having it fall.
There you go. And so, that's not a cheap endeavor either.
No, it's not. And a lot of branches, a lot of tall branches that had to be slowly taken down.
We have woods essentially on both sides of our backyard.
Mm-hmm.
One addition that hadn't been built on, and then the other one chose not to clear it out. And so we wind up with big debris in our yard, depending on these storms, too. And it's, I got it. But you want to prepare for all things possible. If you're new to the show, Consider This is about things that you really need to consider financially, in my opinion, at least. And here's what I know about people like you that are listening to the show, because we take care of people just like you, that most of you come to us or go to a professional financial planner in a time of either a transition or a triggering event. It's when something has usually happened and now you need an answer, now you need a result. What I try to encourage you to do is at least, at the very least, know where you're going when that event happens. That's one of the reasons that we do the show. We take care of people who don't want to worry about their money so that you don't make inefficient financial decisions that lead to frustration. So we provide the show so that you know, okay, if something happens, if I'm this person and I'm ready to go, then the Financial Enhancement Group is the place that you at least want to have a conversation with to see if you're making some of the right decisions. Sometimes it's just to get a second opinion. But secondly, I love to teach. That's where our family background comes from. So I teach money. So today, we're going to go through through a tough conversation that I'm just going to call the annuity for right now. And then we're going to talk about the top five things to focus on at retirement. And we've got about 10 or 15 Investopedia questions, Ken, that we need to get answered. I write for them, answer questions that people call in and ask, as well as for Bob Powell at Retirement Daily with The Street, who also writes for USA Today. So every now and then we'll get to a little bit of that. In the meantime, Ken and I will take a break. We'll be right back in the show. Don't forget, yourlifeafterwork.com.
Hi, Joni Michaels here. We know you care about your money, but are you tired of worrying about it? The Financial Enhancement Group takes care of people just like you who don't want to worry about their money. As fiduciaries, the team at the Financial Enhancement Group will care for your nest egg just like they would care for their own. If they were in your situation, there are many decisions you'll need to make as you face retirement, and the team at the Financial Enhancement Group is here to help you. Call 800-928-4001 or go to yourlifeafterwork.com to set up a time to meet. The confusion and complexity of retirement is almost as daunting as is the excitement of retirement. Don't let your fear and frustration of taxes and investing derail your retirement. Call the Financial Enhancement Group at 800-928-4001. They'll give you a complimentary second opinion on your strategy for retirement. Begin your adventure in your life after work. Call 800-928-4001 or yourlifeafterwork.com. Now back to Consider This program with Joe Clark.
Good morning and welcome back to Consider This. I'm Joe Clark.
And I'm Ken Dilger.
Ken, imagine this. We've talked before that I have a legal obligation to take care of your money as if it were my money and we were in the same situation.
Correct.
It's interesting that when asked, more people than not say that they have that legal requirement, but it's The legal name is a fiduciary. And what you have to ask every single person who is in my shoes is if they are acting as a fiduciary. Now, let me explain that. I am registered with the SEC, with the Securities and Exchange Commission. We have a little over $420 million that we take care of for other people's money across the country, 31 states. And As an SEC registered advisor, I have to function in the form of a fiduciary when it comes to answering questions about your money and telling you what I would do with it.
Okay.
I also have a securities license. That securities license, in my case, is a Series 7, and it lets me sell stuff. Almost said a bad word because that's how I feel about it. It lets me sell stuff, right? So when somebody comes in and asks me to sell stuff, we never do. However, the reason I have the license, and the only reason I have the license, is people hear me on the radio and they go, Joe, I want you to take care of this for me. And they've bought annuities,
mm-hmm.
or they've bought things that already exist, not that I'm selling. But the only way for me to be able to service them is to be able to put my name on that contract so that when you come in to do your family update, I can look at what you have and say, hey, here's what we need to do to unwind this place that you had gotten yourself into. Okay? So there are people, one of my friends says, if they have a securities license at all, they're not acting as fiduciaries, don't go see them. And I said, but Jim, here's your problem. You know I'm acting as a fiduciary, but I have to have the license in order to do it because there's a glitch in the system, so to speak. And so anytime we do anything in our office that where there's even a conceivable chance that it's not acting as a fiduciary, I have a letter that lays that out that says, you know, we are acting with fiduciary intent, but this is a securities product. At the end of the day, you made the decision to buy it. Our job as a fiduciary is to help you unwind it, not sell more of it to you. Does that make sense?
All yep. Right.
So let's go back in the time machine. The time was 1997. So I was 31 years old. We had just started the Financial Enhancement Group October 1st of that year. And it was a different period of time. I didn't have $425 plus million. I didn't have $4 million. So I had no bargaining power with the world in order to be able to negotiate contracts or anything. So if I were to make a suggestion to have you buy a stock or in any type of purchase, the trading cost for a single stock, for a single transaction was $300.
Wow. Right? No matter how much you bought?
The more you bought, the more expensive it could get.
Wow.
But it was $300 for one trade. So if you bought Apple, $300. You bought AT&T, $300, right? Sold it, $300, right? So you really had these transaction charges. And if you've been around the show for a long time, you know one of the things that drives me is what I call the fiduciary focus. And this may very well take us two different conversations to get through. But I want to make sure that it registers to you listening to the program what really transpired then and recognizing that some things change and some things don't. So the decision-making matrix that I used back in 1997 was what we deem the fiduciary focus today. But we wanted to look at risk and volatility. You know, what's going on in the market? What is the amount of risk that Ken is taking or having to incur? The second are the fees and expenses that it's going to cost you to make this transaction. The third are the taxes, but they're both today and tomorrow. And the last but not least is the real return making up for where the inflation is. So that was my checklist, if you will, of what I looked at back in 1997. So when I saw the time frame and the trading cost was, you know, $300 to buy a trade, and the average person who came to see me in 1997, you know, probably had between $50,000 and $250,000. There weren't a lot of families that were coming in that were a lot bigger than that when we first started to practice. It just wasn't the case. So if I took your $100,000, let's just say, and I divided it into 20 different positions, because you need diversification, that would be 20 times $300 each for the individual trades.
That's a lot.
That's a lot of money. It's very, very inefficient use of capital. And so there was this wonderful thing called an annuity back then that allowed me to take money and put it inside of this contract. Now, I will tell you, there's no way in the world that you could get me to do this today, but it's because things have changed, and we're going to walk through this fiduciary challenge, where part of my job is to say, hey, this is when it changed. This is when the line in the sand had been crossed. But secondly, to help you understand where some of those changes occur and what really happens on the backside. Because if it doesn't shock you, well, I'll be surprised. Okay. So the time frame, like I said, is 1997 to about 2002. The trading cost back then were $300 a trade, and it could go up from there. Today, it's $6.95 a trade, and we have about 300 exchange-traded funds that we can use for free, right? So big difference. So now I can take your $100,000 account, and the average people who come to see me today have more than that, but that's okay. But we could take that $100,000, divide it into 20 exchange-traded funds, and you would have zero cost that came from the trading expense, right? Which is what we really, really, really want to get into. Now, the second part of this story that we're going to get into, however, is that inside of a variable annuity, there are things called subaccounts. Technically, they're separate accounts. They look different than to money managers than what a mutual fund does. But for the average person, just checking it out, it looks, smells, and feels like a mutual fund. So let's say we have the Colts and we're back in 1995 and we look on the roster and we see Ken Dilger's name, right? And things are good and ready to go. And then I go home and I buy John Madden Sports and I turn on the Colts and all of a sudden the offensive line is not Mr. Dilger, it's somebody else. That's what often happens in the annuity world, where the real live person that's the money manager and the mutual fund side is not the one that's in the that's inside of the variable annuity, even though they're advertising the same name. So and not the name of the guy, the name of the team. So, you know, this mutual fund family and this fund. So you're led to believe one thing that is not entirely true. Now, we're going to run out of time before I can build a story. So let's just recap. We'll take a break and we'll come back and we'll finish it again. I used annuities back in the late 90s up until about 2002 because the trading cost to buy and sell equities was too great. That condition has changed, and you need to understand that. You're also going to understand, as a fiduciary, the rules that changed. Stick around. Ken and I will take a break. We'll be right back. Go to yourlifeafterwork.com. Find out if you need to learn more about a fiduciary. We'll be right back. Well, good morning and welcome back to Consider This. I'm Joe Clark.
I'm Ken Dilger.
So, Ken, here's what we're working on. We're back in the 1997 timeframe when the Financial Enhancement Group just opened up. That's the flagship company for the show that you're listening to. We had to use annuities at that point in time for smaller accounts, purely because the amount of cost of trading that exists, I shouldn't say purely, right? When I say the fiduciary focus, I was worried about four things: risk and volatility, fees and expenses, taxes today and tomorrow, and real return. So one was the trading cost. So I was worried about fees and expenses. The annuity back then was cheaper because the trading costs were greater. Secondly, I wanted a particular money manager that existed inside of an annuity. Now, Ken, for me to be able to sell an annuity, remember, I'm not acting as a fiduciary. Now,
right.
I can tell you in my heart of hearts, I did what I believed was in your best interest when I did it, based on all of the data that I had. But legally, at the end of the day, you had to say yes and you had to buy it. It didn't mean I was ill will, had bad intentions, didn't mean I wasn't a CFP, right? It just meant when I looked at the metric of what we want to accomplish, that at the end of the day, it was a sale. I got paid if you said yes. I didn't get paid if you said no. Fair enough?
Fair enough.
All right. So I wanted to be able to use the subaccount manager inside of the annuity. And so we went and bought the annuity and put almost all of the money in the annuities, not all of your money, but the money that was earmarked for the annuity, we put in with that one subaccount manager, that separate account. Now, this is the late 90s. And you were not interested in the tech wreck at this period of time because you were doing all sorts of crazy things with, at that point in time, I guess, Tampa Bay.
No, I'm still in Indianapolis.
That's true. You're still in Indy, weren't you? Yeah. So there was this beautiful thing that was coming up called the tech wreck. But from about 1997 through the March 9th of 2000, this place was like printing cash. You know, I had people, well, I can give you one example. We put $25,000 in. And at its high water mark, it was $138,000. I mean, it was just like printing cash. And we began to look at it, and you know, I smelled that something wasn't quite right. So we put in the phone call to the money manager. He lied on a conference call, not with the same firm, but he's still in the business, right? Anyhow, the point that I was trying to make as I started this, I actually have to have a contract with the insurance company to sell you an annuity. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So I went through about, there were about 45 or 50 families that I used this technique with back in between 97 and 99. And what happens inside of a variable annuity is the death benefit can never be less than what you put in, less what you pulled out, right? So if you put in 100, pulled out 50, your death benefit, regardless of market performance, has to be $50,000.
Okay.
Well, back then, your death benefit was actually the high water mark, right? So, Ken, you put in $25,000. It got to $138,000, fell back down to close to $30,000, $35,000. I mean, it was inside of a month. I mean, it was
wow.
It was one of the saddest things you've ever seen in your entire life. The guy had almost all of the money invested in towers for cell service. They got hurt much worse than the dot-coms did. So Crown Castle, you can think of some of these. It was amazing when everything came to light what he had. And it's another reason why I demand absolute transparency so that I know exactly what you own. That's why we don't use mutual funds. That's why we don't use annuities. I want to know if somebody's pulling the wool over my eyes. What do I own? How much of it do I own? So that I can make sure you are properly diversified. So The first thing I did was turn lemons into lemonade, right? So you have a death benefit now that's $138,000, and you've got $33,000. We're just going to call it $30,000 mm-hmm. in cash
okay.
in your contract. It doesn't matter what kind of returns I get. It's going to take a long time before that $30,000 grows up to be more than $138,000.
Correct.
Right. So you're probably going to die with it so that you can get the $138,000.
Okay.
So what I did was went in and I pulled $25,000 out of the contract. Right.
Okay.
And I left $5,000 in.
Okay.
Right. Your death benefit went from $138,000 down to whatever that would be.
$113,000.
And I locked it in 47 times. And I got a letter from the insurance company saying, Mr. Clark, you are an agent of the insurance company, and your duty is to the insurance company, not to these families.
Wow.
And that's when it really, really struck me how significant it is when you're dealing with a fiduciary versus not. They went after my license. Now, fortunately, because of the CFP board and everything else, not only don't I have any complaints, but I also had no liability. My job is to take care of the Dilger family, right? It's not to take care of that variable annuity company. But boy, they were hot and livid. Now, if you fast forward to where we are today, the reality is I am legally obligated to take care of your money as if it were my money in the same situation. But these insurance companies and some of these companies that people work for them would argue that no, their liability not only are they legally required to take care of you, they're legally required to take care of the company and the shareholders.
Interesting.
And that's why you wind up with some of these deals where you have to sell only these mutual funds or only these annuities, or they look at you and they'll say in your review, your product mix
right.
wasn't high enough. You know, don't tell me how many cars you insured. Tell me how many life insurance policies you wrote on top of the cars. That's a common one for the people that I take care of that are in the property and casualty space. And it's, you know, so you really have to get to understand this fiduciary side. Now, remember I told you in the fiduciary world, in the fiduciary focus, It's risk and volatility. So we talked about that. We talked about how quickly it can go up and how quickly it can go down, especially if you don't have transparency. We talked about the fees and expenses. Back in 97, the cost of trading made me need to do one thing. It changed in the middle of the 2000s, and now it's not even close. It's very, very clear. The third was taxes today and tomorrow, right? So when we did this, for the ones that went into IRAs, there was no tax consequence at all. It was the ones that were building tax-deferred money that this was really a sweetheart deal for, that where it wasn't an IRA. Now, the problem is the insurance companies went to the Internal Revenue Service, and they convinced them that when you do a required minimum distribution, you know, that nasty word at 70 and a half, they convinced the insurance companies convinced Congress that you have to do the required minimum distribution off of the value of the benefit or the cash value, whichever is greater. Well, death benefits become worth more the more you age, right? Because you're getting closer to going home, right? And so it created a huge problem. A lot of people that we were able to do this for, Congress unknowingly undid. I mean, they would have never done it if they'd have known what was happening and could understand the complexity of what had really transpired. But it was a very, very interesting thing. So there's challenges out there. So here's my point in this. Understand the difference between somebody who is legally required to act in your best interest and somebody who is not. Make them put it in writing, right? Make them put it in writing so that you know that you have it. Understand the rules, understand that things change, and if you have an annuity that you want somebody to talk to you about, just give us a call, 800-928-4001, or go to yourlifeafterwork.com. Ken and I got to take a break. We'll be right back. While you're at the website, don't forget to get signed up for the Market Carver. Well, good morning, and welcome back to Consider This. I'm Joe Clark.
And I'm Ken Dilger.
Happy to have you along, and you too, Ken. Hope you guys are enjoying this time of year. If you're new to the program, my passion has been helping people prepare for what I call distribution. I've been in this industry since 2 weeks before the crash in 1987 and built our company around distribution planning. I won't tell you that I was this visionary back in 1997. But people ask all the time why our website doesn't say the Financial Enhancement Group. And the answer is people can't spell financial and they can't spell enhancement. it happens all the time. We get checks with large numbers misspelled. They invert numbers and it just happens. And so back in 97, if your website, if you typed something in the browser that was different or spelled incorrectly, AOL didn't know where to take you. I mean, Explorer didn't know where to take you. So you went nowhere.
That's funny.
So our website address is Your Life After Work. It's what it's always been. YourLifeAfterWork.com. This is what we do, is help people take money and figure out how to get it out of accounts. And you'll hear me talk a lot about going from defined benefit plans to defined distribution plans. But we got a great question that came in, and they said, hey, I'm thinking about retirement and going from the accumulation phase to the distribution phase. So I loved that they used the word distribution, Ken. It's kind of like maybe they heard the radio, but they forgot the phase in the middle, right? So some days I call it phase, some day I call it stage. I apologize, I should pick on one, but they both make sense to me. The accumulation stage or phase, in my opinion, is when you are putting money into accounts that are continuing to grow. And when you start in accumulation, you should have two primary objectives. It's saving the right percentage of your income. So it doesn't matter if you make $50,000 a year or $500,000 a year. Agree upon a percentage that you're going to save and save that regardless of whatever it is you happen to make. That's your best shot at being able to replace your standard of living at retirement. Obviously, the earlier you start, Ken, the less you have to save, right? Now, the second goal or objective in the accumulation stage is building tax diversification. That means you want some money that has been taxed, that's in an account that you can put your mitts on if you need it, because you will. There's going to be things that come up, whether it's good stuff like buying a house or putting a daughter in through school, or bad stuff like the car engine blew up, right? You know, it's the good and the bad and ugly of life. And you want to be prepared. Well, eventually, you're still saving money, but what you've already accumulated is now worth so much more than what you're adding this year that the real job moves into what I call preservation. And preservation is when it is very critical to know your discipline, meaning your risk tolerance, how much you can take of market variability, and understand that it's the only time when an average return matters, but you've got to be there beginning, middle, and end. So saying what your average return is in accumulation itself doesn't matter so much because the money's going in at different times. The average return is great to tell you how an investment would have done, but you weren't there then, right?
So true.
In preservation, you are there then, as long as you're able to withstand storms and happiness. So your discipline has got to be really, really strong. At some point, you move into what this person was talking about, distribution. And they had some questions. And it was interesting. There were about 20 answers. And I looked at them. And most of them, I think, are on the right track. They just don't have a process necessarily in place to help people go through what's going on. So our job is to help you understand some of the things that you need to look at. The first one is when you go to quote unquote retire, is not to replace your income. It's to replace your standard of living, right? So Ken, if you go online, and you'll never do this, but if you went online to ask, how much do I have to retire? Almost all of the work that you will read comes from academia, and it will say 70% of your income, right? Now, that may be true if you're in New York City. It may be true in California. After 31 years of being in Central Indiana, what you need is 100% of your standard of living, right? Most of the people who wind up in here do not live paycheck to paycheck, right? They have been good, disciplined. They've done the heavy lifting, Ken. When people come to the Financial Enhancement Group, we don't take credit for what they've saved and accumulated. They did the heavy lifting. Remember, every time you saved money, every time you looked at your beautiful wife and your kids and said, honey, I know we could go to St. John, but instead we are going to Indianapolis, right?
Oh, yeah.
Every time you did that, you were giving up things that you could be doing. You could have been buying boats and places like that. You know, instead, you made the hard decisions. So our job is just to try to help you do the best with the heavy lifting that you've already done. It's to give you the best ways to go. So we want to know what we need for our standard of living. Now, one of those conversations is how much of that do you need that is net or is it gross? So if I say net, that means what you need after taxes. If you say gross, that means you've already factored the taxes into it. And I honestly prefer when people tell me the gross because at least I know they're thinking about taxes. But more often than not, we have the ability through some of our strategies to help reduce what they really need. So when you're thinking about this, what you're trying to put together is a game plan to be able to go through life. So Ken, if you called and you said, Joe, I've got a year before I go, then we're going to do a few things. One, I'm going to make sure that you understand how to read your tax return.
Mm-hmm.
Reading your return lets you make very, very important financial decisions. The second thing that we're going to do is talk about your retirement budget.
Okay.
And we're going to break that down into what you believe is fixed expenses that will be there when you're 65, 85, 95, if God still leaves you here, right? And we're going to talk about social expenses because we know that social expenses decline as people age. It's on an average basis nationwide, it's age 65. The people that come here are at average. It tends to be closer to 68, but at 68, what we find is people can't get away from the grandkids, they can't get away from a doctor, or the comfy couch just feels too comfy, right? And so there's no reason to do some of the normal things that you see happen in computer programs and income profiling. We have a different strategy that we employ. And then we take that and we put it into what we call a retirement practice year. Now, it could be a retirement practice quarter if that's all you got. But we take that budget, and Ken says, okay, I need $8,500 a month. It's a very common number for people in Carmel. I need $8,500 a month. Okay. And we essentially take all access that you have to other money and give you $8,500 a month for a year. And at the end of the year, if you had money left over, you knew that it worked, right? Because what we find is we never have it left over. We either have half of it left over because we totally overestimated what we needed to spend at retirement, or we went through that in about the first 6 months
and spend it all.
And said, either I need to hit a lottery ticket or we're going to have a new retirement practice year, which it's better to know now when we can fix it, right, than to find out later, right? So if you've already retired, that's when we start talking about the V for victory, and we start putting in some of our tax measures, the double stack, things of that nature. So always lots to talk to. That's the first thing about it. They were on some great things. Social Security, a big part of the equation. But if you've got questions, you want to sit down with one of us, give us a call. 800-928-4001. Angie would be happy to talk to you. We'll take a break and be right back. Well, good morning and welcome back to Consider This. I'm Joe Clark.
And I'm Ken Dilger.
We are happy to have you along. Ken, more questions from Investopedia. We normally use this last conversation to do a recap of what we talked about. So I want to hit it first. I went through a story of where we started the firm in 1997, why we used to use products. I talked about how my decision-making process had not changed at all over the 22 years we've had the firm, but at the same time, the conditions that led to different decisions had changed. If you missed that, don't forget you can get our podcast, Consider This Program, to download those first two conversations. You can always find it on our website at Your Life After Work as well. And then we talked about the top five things, and I think there's more than that, that you should focus on if you're thinking about retiring. Ken and I went through the retirement practice year, a few other strategies, and then we took some Investopedia questions. So we'll go ahead and figure it here. Ken, first question, am I in a good financial situation? Now, you know what that question always relates to?
What's that?
Your neighbors.
Yeah,
it's probably. It's always about the Joneses. People will come in and they'll sit down and they'll be 45 years old and they'll have $1.2 million saved and accumulated. They'll have their house already paid for. They've had no debt. They've got no debt. And they'll look at me and go, and how are we doing? Right? Now, they know how they're doing.
Of course.
Right? They already know the answer to that. What they're really saying is, how are we doing compared to other people? And comparison will always get you into trouble. You've right. lived a different life. We talk about the discipline that comes from being able to have $1.2 million, presuming you didn't inherit it. You know, what the things you've had to give up, right, to do that kind of heavy lifting is different than what your neighbor's done, right? So don't get caught up into that game. Make sure that you go through the three phases of finance correctly, save the right percentage of your income. Build tax diversification, even though it hurts along the way. I tell people, you eat broccoli every day. You don't eat chocolate cake every day. And anytime you put money in an investment that's not tax deferred, it feels like eating broccoli, right? Ken and I have talked about it before. I don't remember one time I've ever been excited to go to the gym. I remember a lot of times I've been excited when I'm walking out the door and I can say, I got her done.
Yes.
Right?
Oh, I agree with
that. I got her done. And that's what putting money in a Roth IRA versus a tax-deferred vehicle feels like. Where can I invest my money if I want to be able to easily access it in case of an emergency? If you qualify, a Roth IRA is the beautiful choice. I told Ken in another program with his daughter, if she has any earned income, you can put that inside of a Roth IRA. If she needs that money back, she can get it. One of my favorite strategies, you know, my daughters are running off and one's already married and the other one's considering it. But, you know, I had this strategy because I've grown up over 31 years watching you guys raise your kids. And so I got a lot of wisdom, you know, from people in the family stuff that I was able to apply financially. And what I've noticed, Ken, is your kids most likely spend your money easier than they spend their own.
Oh, easily.
Right?
My son does it all the time. Yeah.
So one of the most tragic expenditures that I've ever seen are what happens at weddings. You know, when you've got a family that's, you know, got a few hundred thousand dollars saved and all of a sudden they're looking at a $50,000 wedding, it's kind of like, whoa, first of all, I would strongly discourage this if I have any ability to do that. But what I was doing was putting money into my daughter's Roth IRA every year. And I told her that when it was time for her to get married, you know, if she bought a reasonable wedding dress, and my wife assured me I don't even know what reasonable means because it's not any of the prices that I'd seen.
Right, of course.
She's, if you buy a reasonable one, then daddy will pay for that. If you want a ridiculous one, right, then that's coming out of an account with your name on it, not my name on it, right? And everybody seemed to understand this concept. So you can always get your principal back out of a Roth IRA without any tax consequences, without any penalty, even the same year you did it. Now, what you can't do is get to the growth. And obviously, if you've invested it in the equities and the equity market falls, the stock market goes down, then you don't necessarily have access to the capital. What are my options? Ken, I'm going to leave this one to you. What are my options if I co-signed on an ex-girlfriend's car loan and she's behind on payments? Because I'm sure in the mortgage world, you've seen this.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Well, your credit's going to get hurt because what is on her credit for a car payment goes on your credit. If she doesn't pay it, it affects both of them. And so either you have to pay it or somehow get her to pay it or pay it off. Or refinance it out of your name into hers only if she can afford it.
If she's not making the payment, the probability is...
not good.
She knows she's got you, right?
Correct.
There's a restaurant in Indy that I still can't figure out why it just up and left. And the only potential business solution I can come up with is that they were so far in debt that selling it to somebody else wouldn't help bail them out of the bankruptcy that they were going to be in anyhow. So why not just close the doors and leave? Still shocks me. But I have seen people in a situation like this where, you know, it's the old frog and the scorpion. The scorpion tries to convince the frog he's not going to sting him. And then, you know, the frog says, well, of course you're going to sting me. And the scorpion goes, no, I won't sting you. And halfway across the water, the scorpion stings the frog. The frog says, now we're both going to die. And he goes, what did you sting me? And he goes, because I'm a scorpion and we sting frogs, right? And... you know, that's the reality. I have seen people in this situation that know they're so spite-filled that they know they're going to be in bankruptcy. So why not take you with them, right? Why not force you? And I've watched moms and dads and grandparents and friends, ex-friends. I've never honestly seen an ex-girlfriend deal like this, but I know that it happens. But just be careful when you put your name on something.
Correct.
We have a very personal experience that's going on right now. And I have to leave the names out because I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings, but somebody decided that they were going to buy a piece of property and they called their kids and said, we're going to buy this property. It's not going to affect any of our investments or anything else, but we want to make sure that you're okay with it. And one of the kids said one thing and the other kid said, well, I don't want to be burdened with that debt, right? And what you need to understand in the United States, if you're listening to this program, is that we are not burdened by another generation's debt. If I die and Barb dies, my kids are not obligated to pay off the debt on the building that I'm standing in right now doing the show. Now, if they want the value of the equity out of it, then they're obligated to the debt up to that point in order to get the equity because the bank still owns more of it than I do. But just keep in mind, if something happens to somebody, that debt does not transfer to that next generation. And I don't know why that confuses people. America's different in that, by the way. In Japan, you can actually put three generations in debt for a mortgage.
Holy cow.
They were the first country to come up with 100-year mortgages. Wow. So people that have never been born. But property values in Japan in 1991 were so great, they had no choice. If they were going to have anybody be able to buy anything, they had to be able to do that. So you've been listening to Consider This Program. I'm Joe Clark along with Ken Dilger. You got any questions or comments, shoot us an email, Consider This Program. Go to our website, yourlifeafterwork.com. Get signed up for the Market Carver. But consider this, we take care of people just like you. Give us a call, 800-928-4001. Have an outstanding week, my friends, as we move into April. Here we go.